Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Voicing Art, a new podcast platforming creative voices on contemporary art from the Arab world, made with Transmission Roundhouse. This week I'm going to be talking to the amazing Carol O'Hare, a DJ and producer based in Beirut. It's Carol's track Decompose that you hear at the beginning and end of every Voicing Art episode, and as soon as I heard the track about 6 months ago, I immediately thought it would be perfect to use for this podcast, even though the podcast didn't really exist at that point, so I sent Carol an email and asked to use it. Luckily, she said yes and also very kindly agreed to let me interview her about her work. The first thing I asked her was, how did she get into the whole DJing thing in the first place?
I used to hang out a lot in pubs in Hamra when I was in university. I used to work a lot, like I used to write a lot, so a lot of pubs would be open during the day. So I became a regular at many of them. And at the time, there wasn't really much effort put into the ambiance. So they used to just put like this random playlist that they would have on, I remember, Windows Media Player playlists, right? And it would be on shuffle and it would be playing random stuff. So one day I got really frustrated and I kept asking them to like just change the playlist or change the music or whatnot. And then eventually one of them was like, why don't you just come and put whatever you feel like listening to? So I did that, and then it just became like a game type of thing. Like, stop nagging about it. If you want to hear something else, just bring your music and put it. One thing led to another, and there was one pub that decided to pay me for it, and he was like, come with your friends and seems like you have a good selection, because they wanted to keep the tracks. So I didn't want to keep the tracks. So I just kind of was standing over the computer all the time, making sure to select the music. So I just kind of found myself in it, you know, one pub led to another. I was very diverse with the style that I used to hear at the time. So I was able also to jump from one place to another as well, either playing hip-hop or a bit of Arabic, traditional Arabic, some indie folk and stuff like that. And then when I started, you know, being more and more interested in electronic, I started introducing electronic music in my DJ sets. So either mashups or edits or remixes and stuff. And then I just kept going, you know. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed standing for 4 hours and kind of creating a story with music. And I had the right crowd for it. People enjoyed it. They enjoyed that they would listen to stuff that we wouldn't normally hear on the radio, because I spent a lot of time selecting my tracks before I would play them. So that's essentially how it started. I was a laptop DJ.
You mentioned narrative there. How do you go about creating narrative in techno or electronic music that has no words?
It's interesting, actually. You kind of go a little bit with the feeling and also the energy. So you start the listening experience becomes different. It's less about whether or not you connect to the story and more about whether you're able to connect with the emotion. So I would... a lot of it would be very much stemming from how I'm feeling as well. So I realized that in winters, I'm more lyrics oriented and I'm more music oriented. And in summers, I'm, you know, a bit more lively, right? And a bit more tribal and percussive and stuff. So I would then just try to create a story like, how do you get to the peak of either that sadness or that lightness in it? And often I would start thinking just about the body. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed looking at the dance floor and and being right about the fact that that melody is going to make the move in this particular manner, or that this vocal right now, when it's going to drop, it's going to make everyone want to close their eyes and be in a dreamy state. So that was how I experimented with the narratives and the story. And I stopped underestimating the power of a really good bass. Yeah, and when I would see a bass come in, or a bass rhythm come in on the drop, and you know, people collectively moving in at least the same direction of a physical movement, yeah, you stop underestimating the power of no words, but just like a really good, solid, round, low frequency that just makes you want to move. And then you wait for it.
That's a great image of everyone moving together as one. Would you say that beyond the dance floor, there's a sense of community around the nightclub scene in Beirut?
Yeah, for sure. That's one of the reasons why I was so eager to stay in it. And I was really hooked on... it was almost only the only sense of belonging that we felt, yani, whether it was listening to music or listening to electronic music together. Listening to something that you can't predict, that you haven't heard before, there was very much a collective sense of belonging. There was an immense amount of support. People were really curious about what they are going to feel when they hear stuff like this. So they were also very, there was a big appetite for new things at the time. Yeah, and I remember in 2011 and 12, you know, at the beginning of these bigger club scenes, things started to kind of settle down in Lebanon. So people were a bit more open and you know, a lot of people started traveling to Europe and saw a different type of nightlife scene, and they brought that back. And so there was a very big sense of urgency to belong to this community, not just belonging to it, but it's like you could feel that everyone wanted to be part of it. Everyone wanted to be there when that DJ was playing for the first time. There was a lot of first times.
In July of last year, the Lebanese Interior Ministry announced a ban on gatherings of LGBTQ+ people. The ban was internationally condemned, and two advocacy groups, Halim and Legal Agenda, quickly filed a lawsuit against it. The ban has now been suspended by the State Council, but only until its final ruling. Nightclubs are often some of the most queer-friendly spaces, no matter where in the world you are. So I asked Carol if she'd noticed any differences in the scene after the ban was announced.
This is a direct restriction to the LGBT community, unfortunately. It's a targeted, systematic targeting by the security, and it's a publicity stunt. So it did affect at the time when it was banned, when the circular came out. It did affect the events that were ongoing, that were outwardly LGBT or that were pro, that were being done within the context of IdahoBit. So they were banned then, but the scene is anyway underground for that. The clubs that are already friendly remained LGBT friendly. A lot of the things are themed, so it's like the community is the society is relatively open now, at least in certain parts and in certain clubs, and that's known. But so as long as it's not outwardly LGBT or exclusively for that, it didn't really get affected directly. So a lot of NGOs got affected that work with LGBT, that host parties at their places, you know, but like the corporate club scene or pub scene wasn't that affected, no.
And would you say that the nightclub scene in Beirut offers a form of escapism to people, or does it engage with societal and social pressures of people's day-to-day lives?
It's a little bit of both. And I think at that point, it's very much linked to the age and the experience as well of the people that are seeking it. So if you're talking from a point of view of being an entertainer or a performer or a DJ, it's much more common now to be a DJ in Lebanon. It's less common to be a producer, for example. So that's why, like in 2018, I started learning production, and I do live sets now more than DJ sets. So there is an appetite for these things because we've done it for a while, and because during COVID people had time to sit at home and all they had was music, so and all they could enjoy at some point was music with a few friends here and there. So it is a form of also trying to reestablish a certain community to belong to, because I remember when I was starting off with this, it was really important to have the community. So it makes sense for these people now to want to go to, in that direction. The form of escapism that I think is also present is more the scene of the party goers rather than the ones that are actually kind of conducting or leading that 1, 2, 3 hours with the public. I think the party going scene is splitting between people that really want to have a listening experience and want to have a themed concept for the night and, you know, want to enjoy themselves, and those that are just really trying to escape reality and hoping that you know, this music or this set or this rave is going to help out with it. Needless to say that when you're there in the party, those things are not really present. Yeah, you don't think about this when you're going. It's only like the second day when you're reflecting, like, was this a nice party? Yeah, I mean, I had fun, but you know, you have a comment about it's not 100%. You don't feel 100% that you're there with other people for the same reasons. Before there was more consensus over, you know, like 10 years ago, we would look at each other as strangers, and you know, we all knew that this was the only space where we can be free right now, and probably the only day of the week where we can be free. So there was like this mutual understanding. Now it's not, there is no, it doesn't look like it anymore. There isn't that harmony in the crowds, I feel.
Moving from being a DJ to being a producer as well, did you find that an easy transition, or were there any pushbacks?
I mean, I turned from DJ to producer in a month, but I was really, really committed to it. I got frustrated with myself because I felt like the type of music that I started, that made me want to start DJing, is no longer being produced. And the scene was going in a completely different direction, and it was becoming harder and harder to find these really good tracks, yani, that I really want to play. So I decided to be a producer because I wanted to produce the music that I don't hear anymore. So ultimately to DJ it afterwards. And because I was a laptop DJ for a few years, I didn't even have a sound card. So when I would prepare 4 or 5 hour sets, I would actually memorize the set and visually try to mix. I couldn't hear the song that's coming in. So a lot of it was really just like on the spot mixing. For some reason, when I started production, it was very easy for me to transition into that. Like deconstructing the tracks that I used to listen to felt like it came very easily. And I was very fast in the sense of it looked like I really had a lot of ideas from the DJ sets that I used to play that were kind of simmering. So when I was given the proper tools and the knowledge, yeah, I mean, I just kind of really soared there and really enjoyed it. It was challenging. I'll tell you what was the most challenging part. The most challenging part was the performance. That's the shift in nature. A performer performing as a DJ and performing as a live producer or a musician, that was something that I felt a few months after I've done it a couple of times, I would be more comfortable. It's a different energy. It's a different aura. You have complete control over every sound in this track. It's not a track that you found online or that you listened to or that you bought. It's a track that you made. So there's a very different, it's like you have to practice to perform live differently than how you would perform as a DJ. So that was what I think took time. Yeah.
I never thought about like the differences between performance with DJs and producers. I guess that also feeds into the whole like persona idea of like Carol O'Hare. Can you tell us just a bit about where that name came from?
So I have big hair, and at the time in 2010, it wasn't very appropriate for women to have like this curly hair that, you know, everyone was like, obsessed with straightening the hair and using keratin and using crystal. I don't know, like there's so many treatments for the hair. So I was part of that movement, you know, of anti-curls and, you know, try to always be proper until one day, you know, although I was trying to tame the hair, everyone would still recognize me in the streets from my hair. So at some point, when I was DJing more and more and they started putting up posters, they were like, oh, no, what's your DJ name? And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go with self-marketing, like something that's already selling itself. Everyone already calls me hair, in Arabic, shar. And in protests and stuff, when we had code names for each other so that we don't use our main names, the code was also the hair. So I just called myself Karol Al-Sha'r. And then I changed Al-Sha'r to O'Hair, which is a literal translation from Arabic to English, which is the hair, so O'Hair, because it was proving to be difficult for foreigners to write up my name and find me online, because there are so many different ways that you can write Sha'r. So I just wanted to remove the confusion. And the hair is the persona itself, like with the headphones and with the jumping around, and like even the audience would kind of try to make links between are you feeling okay? Your hair is like not as poofy as usual. So they would even try to draw links between my mood and how my hair is looking today. So it was it sold itself, yani. It sold itself, so I stuck with it. And I've always identified with my hair. So, yeah, that was it.
I mean, it's a great name, and I love the story behind it. But I think also I wanted to talk about the fact that you're not just a DJ and producer. You also work as a psychology researcher. Is that correct?
I work mainly on strategies and interventions. My background is social psychology and political psychology. So I work during the day mainly with organizations and human rights, civil societies, either on several different marginalized groups or on strategies and consultations or assessments on their projects. So completely different job.
Do you see them as being completely different, or do you think there's ever kind of some interaction between the two?
No. I think they are in perfect synergy, actually. I think I've used, my work in psychology and my approach in research is also very much about groups and narratives and discourses in writing and in words. And I deliver a lot of trainings as well for groups. So I do have the habit of standing in the middle of a room and capturing an audience and experimenting, right, with the boundaries of the space, with the environment, how we can be creative with it. And I do think that a lot of it helped with me kind of having the confidence at the time. I was self-taught DJing. I did take courses in production, but I actually never took courses in DJing. I was self-taught at a time where YouTube didn't exist, and again, being a woman, not a lot of people take it seriously, yeah? So I do see that my work as a psychologist really sparked up the interest in what can be done with nonverbal communication and how I can feel a sense of collectivity through different means other than protesting and activism. And I think it helped me much more in production. And I think that's one of the reasons why production for me came even easier and made so much natural sense for me than DJing, because I have this habit of deconstructing things, putting them together, and then trying to understand how it will be perceived. So I really do think that my work helped. It has inspired me as well a lot in terms of what kind of music I produce for me as my original work. And I also think that the research aspect has really given me the discipline to be able to sit for very long hours and crack something. So I don't see them as totally different. I do see that the lifestyle is not harmonious, for sure. It's hard to keep the balance between such an intense day job that requires a lot of mental effort and an intense night job that requires a lot of emotional and physical efforts.
Would you ever go into production full time, or do you like having kind of the balance of two jobs?
I think I'm going in that direction now. I think this year I've kind of become aware that music before was only 25% of my life and time and energy. I think now it's almost 60% of everything, like most, if not everything that I'm doing has converted into, instead of me writing it in a report, I produce it in a track. So it's going in that direction. I don't think I would go fully only in that direction. Because, yeah, I mean, a very big part of me is also very much a psychologist. So I have in the last year done two projects that are more like social political projects, but the medium was either music production or sound design. So I'm going in that kind of direction where I'm creating the space for both of them to exist. But if that element is missing from, if I become full-time producer and, you know, there isn't that element that's psychological, or, you know, I'm kind of curating a workshop or researching that sound before I actually produce it, I don't think I'll ever, I mean, naturally, I won't go totally in that direction, I think. But I am enjoying now the balance. I'm enjoying how easily I'm able to link up almost everything that I've done in psychology and research and politics and just kind of recreate it all through music. It's like if someone was given another chance to, like, round two, or trying the same thing but in a different way, in a different life, yeah, after some time.
I think the relationship between sounds and places can sometimes be underestimated. When thinking about a place we are familiar with, sometimes our memory focuses more on what the place looks like rather than what it sounds like. But it's really the layers of sound which can transport you. I wanted to ask Carol what her defining sounds of Beirut would be, the sounds which make her city.
It's very conceptual, but I think distant motion, talking, or echoes of talking. You know, space beyond sight. I think everything that you can hear on the periphery of sound, and anything that can be reinterpreted as something else. So glitches and sounds that can sound like one thing or another, right? So these are the sounds that I identify with, that I feel are reminders of Lebanon always, or at least I feel they are absent whenever I leave Lebanon. It's like there's a different soundscape beyond the walls that I'm seeing in front of me of the buildings. That sound cannot be described, it can only be heard.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Voicing Art. If you enjoyed it, be sure to subscribe to stay up to date with new episodes. You can also follow us on Instagram at Voicing Art. Thank you to Carol for speaking to me, and also thank you for letting me use some music. You can go and check her out on Spotify or SoundCloud, and her Instagram is at Carol O'Hare. We're going to end this episode by playing the whole of Carol's track, Decompose.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.